It is never what you might call easy for me to stand in this place and try to preach a sermon. Yet I must confess to you this morning that it is doubly difficult to be here. The last 2 weeks have been full of trauma for me and for my family. For it has been within this period that our 8-year-old daughter has been diagnosed to have acute leukemia. And we have been called on very swiftly to shift from the numbness and the shock that comes from that kind of word to trying to learn how to take care of her and trying to learn how to resume some kind of normalcy to live in the shadow of that kind of enormity. And needless to say, this has not been easy. It has taken a great deal out of all of us. It's been very, very difficult for me to concentrate, much less study or think deeply in these last 2 weeks. And there's still many, many areas of this whole event that I simply cannot speak about. And therefore, the prospects of preparing and delivering a sermon today were exceedingly foreboding. However, to say that is only to say one side of the picture. Long before this happened to me, I had the deep conclusion that it is through events that God communicates with his children, and that it is the very nature of the church to come together periodically and try to share with each other what we think we have heard God saying to us in the things that have happened. Therefore, as painful as it is, as dark as my last 2 weeks have been, there is something in me that has to come to this place and say, it hasn't been all darkness. It hasn't been without its flashes of light. There is something in me that says, I must come to my family in God, you, my brothers and sisters in Christ, and try to share the lessons of the darkness. It is in the language of events that the mystery of Godness is making himself known. Therefore, this morning, please don't expect any kind of homiletical masterpiece. Please don't look to me with any kind of expectations for a highly reasoned, tightly worked out sermon. But if you will rather think of me, if you can, as a broken and burdened brother, limping back into the family circle, trying in halting words to tell you something of what happened out there in the darkness and something of what I think it means, if you will look on what we're about to do in this light, I pray God that he will breathe upon it and will use it to our mutual helpfulness. The first thing I have to say may come as something of a surprise to you, and yet I must in all honesty confess it, and that is I have found no answer to the deepest question of this experience. When I first learned this diagnosis and went off to myself to cry, the question that loomed in my mind is the same question that you would have first asked. I looked to heaven and I said, why? Why did this have to happen? Why do 8-year-old girls get leukemia? Why is there leukemia at all in a world that is supposedly made by an all-good and all-powerful God? Why is there evil? Why is there suffering? Why is there pain? And this question, which has come from countless hearts of men as they have faced the darkness, this question that reaches out across every climate and into every age, there was no answer coming back to the question that I raised. In fact, I searched the Bible. I looked on my shelves of book and all the theology that I have tried to absorb. I tried to remember back all that I had learned. I tried to look through my Christian experience. And I have not found an answer that ties up in any simple and neat solution this horrible enigma of evil. I was already familiar with many of the attempted solutions, and every intellectual attempt to answer this problem always comes up short. It always leaves something out. It always contradicts something else that I believe is true. I have found no answer that enables me to put my mind around this experience and say, aha, I understand. Here is how the mystery is dispelled. Now I see the explanation of it all. I have not found an answer to the most piercing question this experience raises, why should little girls have leukemia? However, the honesty that compels me to tell you that I have found no answer to the question why also compels me not to stop just with that assertion. If it's true that the Bible and the Christian faith gives us no answer that encompasses the whole problem, I must in all honesty say that it does give some things other than an answer that I have found to be of great practical significance. And therefore, just as I don't want in all honesty to overclaim, neither do I want to underclaim or to shut my eyes or my voice to some of the things that have come to me through the biblical revelation and through my experience as a believer in Christ. There have been three things in particular, three gifts in the darkness that I have to tell you about in the name of honesty. First of all, the Bible has helped me because it has challenged me in the midst of this to go on living even though I don't have an answer and even though I don't have an explanation that encompasses this whole problem. It seems to me that the Bible always arranges life and thought in just this sequence. That is, it first calls on us to live passionately and openly and then use our minds to try to understand and interpret what we've experienced. First we live and then we try to think out what has happened. And if we ever get this turned around so that first we think and then we live, I believe life locks in an intellectual impasse and life bogs down completely. Now, this was a very great help to me when the word came that this was the diagnosis of my daughter. Because as I have said to you, I went out to cry, I went out to ask the question, and I found no answer, no encircling light that enabled me to explain this, and yet there were some concrete necessities that were beckoning me in that moment. There was a little girl very sick, and some decision had to be made as to the future course of her treatment. Here was a wife to be comforted. Here was a son who also needed to be stabilized, to be made known that he was important too. And therefore, for me to have said, since I don't have an answer, I'm not going to act, I'm going to go off in some ivory tower and try to think this out before I do anything, would have not only been criminal neglect of my loved ones, but it would have cut me off from the one chance I have to ever get any understanding into this situation. Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick once said, "You can put off making up your mind, but you can't put off making up your life." And this was a very great help to me, for I realized that I had to get on with the business of making up my life. This was far more primary than intellectualizing abstractly, looking around for some answer of the mind when life was calling me to move according to the best light I had. You see, this business of making up life always has to come before the business of making up our minds. It is through living that we learn and interpret. It is not first learning and interpreting and then turning to live. Many centuries ago, a philosopher named Descartes climbed into his famous oven and decided to think out things before he acted. And he finally came to his celebrated conclusion, "I think, therefore I am." And in doing so, he has set the direction of much modern thought, and it was a tragic mistake. He ought to have said, "I am, therefore I think." Because whenever we try to intellectualize first before we live, we are simply turning around the proper sequence of life and thought. We're getting the cart before the horse. You see, we have to make up our lives even though we cannot make up our minds about the ultimate mystery. The fact that we don't have all light should not bog us down and so we say, "I will do nothing." But we must take the light that we have, limited that it is, walk step by step, and believe that through living
we come to understand, rather than first getting all understanding and then turning to live. Therefore, it was of great practical help to me to realize that though I did not have an answer that encompassed it all, I did have a beckoning to live, and maybe as I lived, facing what had to be faced, experiencing what had to be experienced, maybe some insight would come later on, but until then, I had to be true to the concrete business of making up my life. And maybe after I have done this a while, the making up of the mind will come. Therefore, the Bible was of tremendous help to me in saying, live and then think. Don't become immobilized in your mind so that you are not free to do what you can with the light that you have. The second gift that the Bible gave to me was a stern warning against superficiality, against jumping to hasty conclusions, against labeling the experiences of life too swiftly, good, bad, evil, or hopeless. Now, if the Bible teaches us anything about the flow of life, it teaches us that this is a deep and mysterious process. Just as an iceberg shows only a fraction of itself above the surface, so the events of life, according to the Bible, always have more to them than meet the naked eye. There is always more happening in a moment than you realize. There is always a potential hidden beneath the surface, and we must never jump to conclusions just like that. Here is something, it looks bad, therefore everything is hopeless. Now, this was a very practical help to me the other day, because when this word of diagnosis came, it would have been so easy to say, all pain is evil, all sickness is bad, leukemia, that means instant death, that means inevitably moving toward the abyss, therefore all is lost, there is no hope, embrace despair. It would have been so easy under the first appearing of this event to have buckled and to conclude that it was all bad. However, this gift of the Bible said to me, be patient. Wait. God has not finished with anything yet. There is a substructure of life. There is meaning that is not apparent on first sight. And before you run out and pronounce something and conclude something and embrace something, let life run its course. Let events reveal themselves. Unwrap the package. See what is really inside, for it may be different than the covering. Be patient. Wait upon the Lord. Wait and be patient in good courage. I must say that the experience of the Old Testament character of Joseph has stood me in good stead in these 2 weeks. You may remember the story of that man whose life was filled with trauma. In fact, it seemed like that everything that happened to Joseph at first was bad. He didn't deserve all the blows that came to him. And yet all underneath that story is a kind of double agenda. For example, he was the pampered, favored son of his father. And therefore he became quite a cocky little fellow, and his other brothers could see nothing in him but arrogance and impotence, always coming to the breakfast table with his big talk of dreams, where everybody was serving him. What they could not sense was that Joseph had in him to be a great leader of men. He had tremendous capacities, and what they thought was evil on first appearing was really the first surfacing of these leadership qualities. His brothers came to despise him, so much in fact that they kidnapped him, sold him into slavery, sent him off to Egypt, an act that seemed to have every mark of evil and absurdity. Yet wait a minute. As the long decades unfold, it turns out that the rigors of slavehood in Egypt brought out the character of Joseph in a way that the pamperedness of his father could never have done. He was put to some tests there that I don't believe his father would ever have allowed him to be put to, And in this rigorous life, a character was born, and he finally catapulted to a place of prominence so that he was able single-handedly to keep the children of Israel from starving to death. Now, if you read the story of Joseph on the surface, you can very quickly jump to conclusions, all of them wrong. If you allow history to unfold, if you let the great not yet be what it is, that is full of unknown potential, what we think is evil can well work out to good. Therefore, the biblical injunction to beware of superficiality, to wait instead of jumping to conclusions, to be slow to say, this is good, this is bad, this is evil, this is hopeless, this stood me in good stead. What I'm saying is that the Bible has taught me that despair is presumption, pure and simple. It is going beyond the evidence. It is taking a conclusion that we have no right to take. How do I know that this thing, which seems to me so horrible, is not carrying in it some deep and wonderful blessing? How can I say right now, this is all bad, there is no hope, and therefore embrace despair? I am not going to do it. In fact, I am applying to my own daughter's situation this great sense of the openness of the not yet, and I'm going to wait until God gets through with all this. Who knows? Maybe Laura Lou is going to be the one on whom the great breakthrough for a cure of leukemia is going to come. Maybe God is going to heal her instantly. Or maybe even if she dies, there's going to be something in it to the glory of God, something unbelievable that he's going to accomplish. God is not through with this yet. Despair is presumption, and this is a great gift which the Bible has given me in these 2 weeks. I am not to jump to conclusions. I am to wait upon him whose thoughts are not our thoughts, whose ways are not our ways. He is not through with anything yet. I will not close the doors on the potential of the great not yet. And this is a great gift, to have this sense of openness. However, I must say that the greatest and most precious of all the gifts is not just this challenge to keep on living even without an answer, or this sense in which we must be very patient before the unfolding of God's mystery. The greatest gift of all is the picture of God, which flows into my life from the biblical revelation and gives me the basis of positive hope. Now, I have just said that despair is presumption, and I believe this. We have no evidence on which to embrace the dark negativisms of the future. However, that's not even the greatest gift of the biblical revelation, for it depicts a kind of God which does not make us just be neutral and open to the future. We can even have some positive hope because of what he is and because of what he has done. Now, I don't have time to try to apply all of theology to all of tragedy. However, there are two things about the biblical God that have really become tremendously significant to me in these days. The first is his understanding of human suffering and pain. He not only made this world, he cares about it so much that again and again in the Old Testament, he comes among his people, and then in the fullness of time, he came down the back stairs of Bethlehem and into the stream of history. He sent his only son, made in the likeness of man. The word become flesh. God became one with us to learn what it's like to be a human upon this earth. Now, this Son of God did not try to evade pain and suffering. In fact, he opened himself to its full brunt. And I think it's interesting that the one verb that is used to describe the life of Jesus in the great Apostles' Creed is the verb suffer. Have you ever thought about it? It says that he was conceived of the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary. It says that he was crucified, dead, and buried. And between those two, there is one phrase for his life. He suffered under Pontius Pilate. Yes, he took into his own being all that it means to suffer and know pain and know evil. This means that in Jesus, God has drawn infinitely near, made common cause with our humanity, so that he can now come and say to us, I know what you're going through with. I have felt what you feel. I have walked the road. I know what it is that you're suffering. Now, there's no way to describe how close you feel to a person who has shared some of your same agony and who knows the hurts that you're feeling. Well, now, I just can't tell you what that one thought has meant to me as a sustainer in these days. Because I have stood more than once by the side of my little girl. I have seen her suffer, and I have thought to my soul, I can't stand it. I can't stand to see her suffer. And more than once, I've remembered, and suddenly I was not alone. Suddenly it was almost as if there was a companioning presence, almost like a hand on the shoulder, almost like hearing the words, I know, John, I know. I watched my boy suffer. I know what it's like for your heart to break for your own flesh and blood. I've been where you are. I know what you're going through. And believe me, in the darkness, the companionship of understanding, it's beyond value. You can't say what it means to know that he who abides in the heavens knows what it's like down here on earth. The other thing about God that is so sustaining is to see what he did with evil and pain and suffering. His boy went through a worse agony than I've ever thought about. He was put to a cross, there suffered unbelievable hatred, unbelievable pain. And do you know what God did? He let him die, but then he overcame all of that evil. He brought Jesus through this. 3 days later, he was back on earth as real as ever. And then, miracle of miracles, he took that whole evil experience and gathered it up into his purposes and turned it inside out and now uses the cross, evil as it is, as an instrument of his goodness. That is, he takes pain, he overcomes pain, he transforms pain into the servant of his purpose. Now, this is incredible. This means that in all that is happening, we are not going to be destroyed. He is going to bring us through this, and not only bring us through, he's going to take our agony and turn it back on evil and transmute it into goodness and into the servant of his purpose. Now, my friends, this is my bedrock hope about what's going to happen in my experience. I believe that God is going to take all of this dark mystery, and I know that he is going to bring my little daughter through. She may suffer, she may even die, but she's not going to be destroyed. There is going to be survival through the power of God, and he is somehow going to take this experience and do with it what I can't even imagine now how. He's going to turn it inside out and use it now, as it seems so evil, into an instrument of his good. Why do I dare to believe this? Because if God did it for his boy,
I believe he's going to do it for my girl. Which brings me back to the place I started. I don't have an answer. I don't have any explanation of why little girls get leukemia, of why there's suffering and evil in a world that God has created. I don't have an answer, but I do have three precious gifts that come to me out of the Bible. I have the challenge to go on living, even if I don't have an answer. I have the warning that I must not be superficial and jump too quickly to conclusions about the great not yet. But best of all, I have a vision of God who has drawn near to me in Jesus Christ and who understands what I'm feeling, and one who is so resourceful and so powerful that he once took the worst and made it an instrument of his best. And if he did it then, I believe he can do it again. And so I intend to try to go with your help and God's, to walk with what little light that I have, to move forward, to give thanks to God, to have hope. And I intend as best I can not to embrace despair, but to take this agony daily and offer it up to the mystery of God. And I believe with all my heart that if I do this, something will happen. The spot will be marked. This week, as I was reading a book by Dr. George Buttrick, I was deeply helped by something that he said about the Dead Sea in Palestine. I've heard at least 100 sermon illustrations about the two seas in the Holy Land, the Sea of Galilee, which is sparkling and fresh and has fish living in it, and then the Dead Sea, which does not have any fish, but its salt content is so high that there's no life there. I've heard the illustration that it's because the Jordan River flows through the Sea of Galilee and only into the Dead Sea that there's such a difference between life and death. Well, Dr. Buttrick says that that truth is there, and yet he dares to make another truth that to me was life-giving. He said it was wrong to say that there's no outlet from the Dead Sea. Now, in a sense, it is a dead end. The water flows down to that low place, and there's no place else for it to flow. But Dr. Buttrick reminded me that there was an outlet, and that was the outlet upward, the outlet to the sun. And he said through the years, as the water has flown there with no place else to go, but then has surrendered itself to the sky, has been evaporated and is left a residue, that there has built up around the Dead Sea a whole reservoir of potash, potash being the main ingredient of fertilizer, which if it were mined and distributed, would be enough to cover the whole surface of the earth for at least 5 years. Now, fertilizer is a form of life. It is not life that fish can live in, but it is that which can give life to others. And he dared to suggest that even in the Dead Sea and its surrender to the sky, there is hope that when we reach a dead end, when it seems that there is nothing we can do, if we will remember the upward outlet, if we will offer what we have to the sky, that even that will be received and life will mark the spot. This is my hope. I'm going to do everything I can. I'm going to stay wide open to what might be in the not yet. But if I get to the complete end, where there's nowhere else for the water of my trouble to flow down, I'm going to surrender to the sky and believe that even there, if it's just potash, something of life will show for it.